B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, April 3rd, 2019. Using Trump tactics, the president of Ecuador, who is under fire in a domestic corruption scandal, is lashing out at Julian Assange and Venezuelan President Maduro. He'll do anything, say anything, to try to slip out of the scandal that has engulfed him. We credit Elizabeth Voss at Consortium News for breaking the story today that Lenin Moreno, the president of Ecuador, has said he would decide in the short term the fate of Julian Assange after falsely claiming that WikiLeaks had repeatedly violated the terms of Assange's asylum in the London Embassy of Ecuador by commenting on a scandal linking a Panamanian investment company with Moreno and his family. Now, terms were imposed on Julian Assange at the end of March last year. They're called a protocol, and Assange never agreed to that. But in a tweet from WikiLeaks, not attributed directly to Assange, it reads, Ecuador's President Lenin Moreno stated today that Assange had violated the conditions of his asylum and that he will take a decision in the short term after WikiLeaks reported on the existence of the INA Papers offshore corruption scandal that is racking his government. Now, WikiLeaks has reported on the scandal, but they haven't published any documents. And that is the claim that comes from Lenin Moreno. And Elizabeth Voss did a search at WikiLeaks and found that there are no files that link to that on the WikiLeaks site. So the scandal surfaced in February when a legislator in Ecuador told reporters he'd received a dossier anonymously filled with documents that will implicate Lenin Moreno and his family in alleged crimes of corruption, perjury, and money laundering. That was followed by an effort to cover it up by the president of the National Assembly, who's also come under investigation for her role in this scandal. So, here is the Trump tactic. You lie, and you blame other people. So, Moreno claimed last night that Maduro, Assange, and the opposition leader in Ecuador are trying to bring down the government after an embarrassing offshore and lavish spending scandal. Now, Moreno, this is a quote from the article, appears to have attempted to deflect from the growing scandal by using it as a pretext to blame WikiLeaks and expel Assange. Now, the former ambassador, I guess he was actually consul, at the Ecuadorian embassy, his name is Fidel Narvaez, he tweeted about this, "It is absurd that the government of Lenin Moreno intends to link Assange with publications of pages totally unrelated to WikiLeaks or with the contents of the New York Times, and it would be ridiculous for the prosecution to investigate a leak that does not exist, but only in the false news published by the newspaper that Lenin Moreno directs." And he went on, "Exactly a year ago, the government isolated Julian Assange in a regime that is almost a prison. And Assange has since then not issued a single tweet. The government is looking for a pretext to end Julian's asylum and prepares the conditions to subject the country to historical humiliation." In a separate article, Narvaez is quoted, "Despite being an outrageous accusation, the farce has gone so far that the Ecuadorian National Assembly has issued a resolution to investigate Julian and that it emboldens the government to take measures to protect national interest. In short, the government seeks a false pretext to end the asylum and protection of Julian Assange." So this is a very interesting development. It could risk the expulsion of Assange. And it's possible that Moreno may see it in his best interest to try to deliver Assange to the United States in hopes of wriggling out of the scandal that he is, you know, kind of wrapped up in Ecuador. And last December, the New York Times reported that in May of 2017, Paul Manafort flew to Ecuador. That would have been after the non-existent meetings with Assange in London that The Guardian reported and has still not retracted. At any rate, Manafort did engage in discussions with President Moreno, during which Moreno discussed handing over Assange in exchange for concessions like debt relief from the United States. So this is interesting to see the way corrupt leaders of the world view our corrupt leader and what kind of leverage or gamesmanship that all enables. And meanwhile, Chelsea Manning remains locked up in Alexandria, Virginia, held in contempt for refusing to testify to the WikiLeaks grand jury. And her lawyers have filed an appeal, which I find quite compelling. Here are a couple of quotes. Manning's conditions of confinement must either be modified so as not to constitute punishment, or she must be released. And, of course, at issue here, they're trying to get her to answer questions. And in some respects, they require her to relitigate her own military court-martial from years ago. Now, the attorneys argue, quote, Manning has been kept in solitary for nearly a year during her confinement at Quantico. She was kept, I'm sorry. As a result of studying her case, a UN special rapporteur on torture issued reports defining solitary confinement as tantamount to torture after it becomes prolonged, and he defined prolonged as more than 15 days. Continuing to quote the appeal, while Manning objects on humanitarian grounds to anyone enduring such treatment, she recognizes that it is likely lawful for the jail to segregate people who are being subject to punishment. Now, they say that her solitary is for her own protection. But this does cross the line into a form of punishment, and that does not comport with the regulations of contempt of court. Manning has raised grave concerns about whether the jail could accommodate her daily post-surgery medical needs. She reminded the court that the only legitimate purpose of civil confinement is coercion, and that any such confinement may not be transformed into punishment without due process of law. So, Manning's lawyers presented the judge with a packet of information from her surgeon, her doctor, a medical expert in transgender health, and two of the world's foremost experts on the risks faced by transgender persons. Judge Hilton received this packet of letters and set them aside. He did not read them prior to ruling. He didn't even flip through them or unfasten them from the binder clip, which they were secured by. And Manning mentioned that both Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo have expressed resentment toward Obama's decision to commute her sentence and suggested the subpoena that brought her into this whole dust-up may be a mechanism of exposure and harassment. Well, I hope the attorneys find a good appeals court and get a solid ruling in favor of her release. And AOC, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has tweeted support for Chelsea Manning. Quote, solitary confinement is torture. Chelsea is being tortured for whistleblowing. She should be released on bail. Well, I want to say that I support the Congresswoman on this, and also I watched her town hall meeting hosted by Chris Hayes on MSNBC last Friday evening. I was really impressed with her. She knows what she's talking about when it comes to the Green New Deal, and I thought she comported herself very well and answered a lot of the questions that were presented and was quite persuasive in her presentation. I am still waiting for her definitive statement on the U.S. position toward Venezuela, and the best I could find was praise for her calling Maduro a dictator. And that praise came from an anchor on Fox News. But I don't find any explicit statement from AOC on Venezuela in an online search. Now, separately, Ocasio-Cortez and other fresh women members of the House are fighting back after the leader of the Democratic Campaign Committee, the DCCC, Sherry Bustos of Illinois, declared that the DCCC will not conduct business with any political consultant who works with an opponent of a sitting member. So this is incumbent protection. It is fundamentally undemocratic. And I'm glad to see that Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley from Massachusetts, and Pramila Jayapal from Washington State are all trying to, in their view, quietly work with the caucus to change this. And they say that they will take it to Speaker Pelosi, who has endorsed this blackball effort, if they need to. And Ro Khanna, from the Progressive Caucus, a congressman from Silicon Valley, who challenged Pete Stark, I guess it was about 6 or 7 years ago. Pete Stark was a longtime member of the House from the East Bay. Ro Khanna challenged him. Stark won that election. And then Khanna moved to a different district in Silicon Valley. And Eric Swalwell came in and knocked off the incumbent. And Ro Khanna knocked off a longtime sitting congressman from San Jose, Mike Honda. That's how they got there. And Khanna, so far, hasn't forgotten. He said this goes against the very idea of competition of ideas. That's the heart of democracy. It's protecting the status quo and entrenched power against potential outside voices. What unites, I think, all these cases is the view that you should have a healthy competition of ideas and welcome spirited elections. And trying to squelch that is why this has struck such a nerve. So you may have heard that George Clooney, Elton John, and Ellen DeGeneres have all announced that they are boycotting the Beverly Hills Hotel and the Bel Air Hotel. It's because they are owned by Sultan Hassani Bolkiah, who is the leader of Brunei. And Brunei has announced a new draconian law that punishes gay sex and adultery by stoning offenders to death. Thieves can face amputation of a right hand on a first offense, left foot on their second. And the new laws also apply to children and foreigners, even if they're not Muslim. Now, I'm deeply offended by these laws. I support this boycott 100%. And we have a separate boycott that has been announced here in California in favor of defending the rights of LGBTQ persons. California's Attorney General, Javier Becerra, has named South Carolina as the 10th state that's being boycotted by California. It's a travel ban for government employees and elected officials. I also support this effort. It started with the transgender bathroom ban in North Carolina in 2016, and I support that boycott. But why is it that I'm not supposed to boycott Israel? That I can't support boycott, divestment, and sanctions? And I hate to get into a kind of comparative misery or comparative risk analysis here. And I do take seriously what's happening in Brunei. But when you compare that to the plight of the Palestinians and a couple of million people who are locked down on the Gaza Strip and a million or so more on the West Bank, whose rights are routinely violated by the apartheid policies of the Israeli government. And yet political leaders of both parties support legislation to suppress my First Amendment right to engage in boycott of Israel. But it's okay to boycott retrograde states and the nation of Brunei. Sorry, that's not rational. And I don't believe it's constitutional. And speaking of Javier Becerra, he's a man I like and respect. He was a member of Congress for many years, and I interviewed him several times. He's smart. He's likable. But he's been on the wrong side of a dispute here in California. Last year, after years of effort, the state legislature passed and Governor Brown signed a law requiring the files of police misconduct to be open for public inspection. For years, they've been called personnel issues, and as bad cops were either disciplined or given a free pass by their bosses, the public was told, this is secret. You can't see it. So as the law went into effect January 1st, We saw a series of lawsuits from police officer unions and other associations saying, you can't allow this. It's not retroactive. You can't release files from 2 years ago or 5 years ago. And to his discredit, Javier Becerra supported the cops in keeping this information secret. And that position has been overruled in a precedent-setting decision by a state court of appeal. Only the state Supreme Court now could overturn that and rule in favor of the cops. You may have heard that Trump is getting ready to appoint an immigration czar. And one of the top candidates is Kris Kobach of Kansas. Greg Palast always reminds me that to use all three of those K's because it kind of represents the mindset of the man who was Secretary of State, who ran the interstate cross-check list, and who has a history of being deeply racist. And in the article I've linked to in the show file for today's podcast, Greg Palast opens with this. When the young Kris Kobach created a computer system for the Department of Homeland Security that secretly tracked visiting Muslims, President George W. Bush was so offended that he personally ordered the racially offensive program shut down. And now Kobach may have power over that department and all others dealing with immigrants. If Trump's reported consideration of him as immigration czar becomes a reality. And here are four quick points. Kris Kobach drafted Arizona's notorious SB 1070 law, the driving while brown law that was found unconstitutional by federal courts. He lost a federal suit for unconstitutionally requiring proof of citizenship to vote in Kansas. He directed the infamous interstate cross-check list that I referenced earlier, the vote purge system for 30 states, 10 of which have recently dropped out of participation. He wrote local laws, all struck down by courts, which made it a crime to conduct business with a, quote, illegal alien. And he bamboozled towns into hiring him for a failed legal defense of racially poisonous statutes and racked up fees of $100,000 in many of those instances. And Greg Palast goes on to document what you may have seen in his film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, when he ambushed Kris Kobach at some sort of a summer picnic and asked him about the cross-check list. So this is powerful information that you should note. And the biggest surprise that came in my news roundup process today is a piece from the Washington Post. They attended a meeting here in the Bay Area on Monday where billionaire Carl Choke. I'm not going to edit this out. I'm just going to leave that as it is. I meant to say Charles Koch. And this report opens, Charles Koch doesn't just think Trump's threat to close the southern border is terrible. He'd do the opposite. Quote, I would let everybody in who comes here to contribute and no one who wants to come here to do harm. And see how easy this is. This goes to our whole philosophy of openness. We have to have an open society, open to ideas, people, goods, and services, to learn from each other and have us all benefit. Now, consider that Charles Koch is the leading patron, the leading benefactor of Kris Kobach. And so imagine my surprise. It was a little bit of whiplash early this morning when I was reading these reports, both the Palast and the Washington Post. Another quote from Charles Koch. He complained that leaders in both parties agree that the immigration laws need to change, but they think it'll help the other party more, so they won't do it. And we can't make any progress on policies that a great majority of the American people and even the majority of politicians agree would be the right thing to do. Okay. I'm a little surprised. And speaking of elections, Adam Eichen, who I featured in a podcast about 6 weeks ago here, he is promoting the idea with Lawrence Lessig from Harvard to use ranked choice voting in the 2020 Democratic primary. Because there's so many candidates, Eichen makes the case that because the Democrats use proportional allocation of delegates and because they have a minimum threshold of 15%, Voters who support candidates who don't beat the 15% threshold are essentially wasting their votes. And Eichen speculates that because Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden are the only ones who poll consistently above 15%, that if the election were held now, somewhere around 50% of the vote could fall into the wasted category. So he goes on to make a good argument that ranked choice voting, which allows you to list not only your top choice, but additional choices, and then those can be folded into the vote count if nobody achieves a clear majority. I think it is a very interesting proposal, and the caucus states appear to be the first places where this might be implemented. The Iowa Democratic Party proposed using ranked choice voting for those who cannot attend the in-person caucuses. Nevada, Hawaii, Alaska Democratic parties are integrating ranked choice voting in their delegate allocation plans, and I think that is a good idea. They're also gaining progress in getting this implemented in Maine. And in New Hampshire, they had a really good hearing, but the bill ultimately failed to advance out of committee. So that's an interesting update from Adam Eichen. And I got a nice email yesterday accusing me of being a victim of Trump derangement syndrome. And this comes from Robert Blumen, a longtime listener and a man who sends me very interesting articles from publications that I generally don't look at. And he opens by saying, look, as you know, I'm a big fan of your show. Let me preface by saying I have huge respect for the independent thinking people on the left who saw that the whole Russiagate thing was bullshit and took a contrary position for 2 years while the insanity raged. Probably cost yourself something in terms of personal connections, friendships, and reputation. Yes, that's true. But I think you have a moderate case of Trump derangement syndrome. Not as serious as Rachel Maddow, probably curable. And he dings me on 2 points. One is the legitimacy of the Trump election. Whatever Trump did to win some states, are you going to count all the Democratic practices in other states? What about other elections where the Democratic candidates cheated better than the Republicans? Well, I acknowledge that both parties do indulge in election manipulation or rigging. But when it comes to the 2016 election, the Republicans were far and away ahead of the Democrats using voter suppression tactics. And then there was the count in Michigan, which, according to Greg Palast and others who've looked into it, there were 75,000 ballots where people voted for somebody in different offices, but it showed no vote for president in Detroit. Yeah, right. Then he says, regarding impeachment, I'd say the same thing. The stuff you think is impeachable falls well below the noise level of what elected representatives do every day, and no one cares. I'm sorry, I don't agree, Robert, because the efforts by Trump to use Michael Cohen to pay hush money to the girls, I believe, is a clear impeachable offense. And it is something that is up to the members of Congress, the Democratic majority in the House, to decide. Because impeachment is not based on specific criminal statutes. And while he says you need something actually really serious to be impeachable, minor corruption is not enough, I don't agree. The standard is quite flexible, and it takes the political will to proceed. Thanks for your comments, Robert, and I do appreciate comments even when people don't agree with me. It's actually more interesting than reading Valentine's. So feel free to send your critiques or your agreement to peter@peterbcollins.com. And every day we like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions, including Carl Howard, Lyle Stewart. I'm turning the page here. I'm sorry, that was Lyle Rubin. Sorry, Mr. Rubin. Jerry in Southeast Portland, and our favorite Siri, not the one who answers my phone, Siri Walgren in far north California. Thanks to each and every one of you. If you're not a subscriber, we can fix that in just a minute. You could even pause this podcast right now. Visit peterbcollins.com, click on menu, then click on become a subscriber, and very soon you can make your choice of $5, $10, $20 a month. The $50 annual subscription gets you a bonus book. We currently have two options, Trump on the Couch by Dr. Justin Frank and 2100, A Dystopian Utopia. And I would love to pass Vanessa Keith's beautifully produced book, which projects a future adapting to climate change. I think you'd find it fascinating. And it's a great value. It's a $55 book, so for $50, you know, you're saving a few. No surprise, Jerry Nadler, chairing the House Judiciary Committee, got authorization from the majority to issue subpoenas to get the Mueller report. But he is not going to implement it right away. I will give him some time to change his mind, said Nadler. But if we cannot reach an accommodation, we'll have no choice but to issue subpoenas for these materials. I think it's going to be a long battle over that. You probably heard yesterday's bizarre malaprop from Trump. He was talking about the origins of the Russiagate scandal. And three times, he substituted the word oranges for origins. And, you know, you can't make this stuff up. The guy's just an idiot. And we learned that over the weekend, there was a breach of security at Mar-a-Lago, where Trump goes to hang out with his rich buddies and have them fawn all over him. And we know that it was disclosed after the Robert Kraft visit to the massage parlors for a happy ending. We learned about the woman named Cindy Yang, a Chinese native who was selling access to Trump on websites that have since been taken down. So this latest visit was from a woman from Shanghai, 32-year-old Yujing Zhang. She said, oh, I want to use the pool. My friend Charles said I could. They let her in. And later, when she said she was there for some United Nations Chinese American Association, a receptionist tipped off security. This woman's not legit. So then the Secret Service followed up. They found four cell phones, a laptop, an external hard drive, and a thumb drive that contained malicious software. Now, this just is another example of how reckless Trump is. And he doesn't care. I don't know what this woman was up to, but the Secret Service is really pissed, and they blame the Trump staff at Mar-a-Lago for the problem. Apple executive Andreas Gall has sued the Customs and Border Protection Unit at San Francisco International Airport. He had one of those global passes, but when he returned to SFO from an overseas business trip, he was detained by security officials. They demanded to open his phones and his laptop, and he said no. He said, because I have proprietary materials, and I've signed non-disclosure agreements not to let anybody see them. And the harassment that he received based on the lawsuit, he believes that he was detained and harassed because he has been outspoken on initiatives to prevent warrantless mass surveillance and spread the use of encryption. And he criticized the FBI for the efforts they spent to hack the phone of the alleged San Bernardino shooter. And he still has questions about why he was treated this way. I want to recommend a great piece over at the Gray Zone Project today under the byline of a Venezuelan journalist, Misión Verdad. And she's done a great job of presenting a strong and compelling case that the electrical blackouts that have plagued Venezuela recently were the product of sabotage. And by really detailing the timeline of events, some of the commentary that came from people like Marco Rubio and John Bolton and Elliot Abrams, you can build a strong argument that it was sabotage, probably by the U.S., that has created the blackouts and the ripple effect. You can't buy gasoline, your ATM card doesn't work, the phone system goes down. And as Grayzone pointed out in a previous article, this tactic is a part of the playbook that has been used by the U.S. government to train insurgents in other parts of the world. So, according to this article, In stage one, they hacked the main computer and control systems at the biggest hydroelectric facility at the Guri Dam. Then they blew up transformers, and there also was the use, they say, of electromagnetic pulse devices. Now, that's a super weapon, and it's believed that the U.S. has them. So there's a lot of detail in this article. I hope you'll click on the link and follow it up and read it when you have an opportunity. And following up on our interesting interview with Aaron Leonard about the FBI and its dark history, I found a story. I've linked to it in the show file, and it is published by the Foundation for Economic Education. They list 8 historic cases that show the FBI and CIA were out of control long before Russiagate. Makes for good reading. Check it out. And finally today, I want to congratulate the voters of the city of Chicago, often called the Second City. And it was the second city where I lived. I went to Northwestern University, and I worked in radio in Chicago in the 1970s. The Daily Machine is no longer operational because yesterday, voters elected a black woman who's a lesbian, a former federal prosecutor, Lori Lightfoot. She won overwhelmingly, 73% of the vote. It is a huge repudiation of the Democratic machine started by Richard J. Daley, later run by his son, and it was bequeathed to Rahm Emanuel. And this is an important step forward. And Ms. Lightfoot, Mayor Lightfoot now, was central to the investigation after the killing of Laquan McDonald. And I hope that she has a mandate to try to clean up the police department and also clean up the communities where gun violence is all too often a daily feature. Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. You're free to share it far and wide. It's on YouTube, and I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.